Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
How are you all?
Well,
good.
Feeling included?
You're right.
Hey.
Good. This sense of community is so important. How are you doing over there?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
We're happy you're here. I was, for some reason, moved to take up something I had read long ago. How many of you know the Shodoka? And that is actually available in this book, Buddhism and Zen by Yogen Senzaki and Ruth Strout, the Canvas. Huh? No?
Yes.
Yes, some of you remember. And the book was brought out in 1953. I was born in 1943, and I had already started sitting, but absolutely no knowing what I was doing. And somehow this book came into my possession later on. It was brought out, as I say, in 53, and Yogen Senzaki died May 7th, 1958, so 5 years later. And as I was preparing these materials, I came upon this painting by Hoan Monica Bradbury, who is here today. After many, many months of not being able to join us. And this is from a gallery exhibition from 2015 at Upstream Gallery, Hastings-on-Hudson. Wonderful. So my first foray into formal Zen practice was 1967. That was at Zen Studies Society, West 81st Street, its first home. And in 1987, 20 years later, a new edition came out of Buddhism and Zen. So some of you probably found it in this, yes? And as you know, there's a foreword by Robert Aitken in this later edition, 1987 edition. And I just wanted to read a couple of things that Aitken says in his foreword, because he was lucky enough to actually be able to practice with Yogen Senzaki. And so I was saying, from 1967, I started sitting. In 1947, he met Yogen Senzaki, and 20 years later, did this forward. After Yogen Senzaki was released from Heart Mountain concentration camp, he went to Los Angeles, back to where he had been living, and was given a room in the Miyako Hotel by a fellow internee who owned the place. So Aitken says, it was here that I met him in December 1947. At this time, he had perhaps 30 American students and another 30 followers who had been with him at Heart Mountain. 15 to 18 English-speaking students would crowd into his room for Zazen and a lecture 2 evenings a week. The Japanese students would come for sutras and zazen on Sunday mornings. We sat on folding chairs, and there was very little ceremony. We had no membership arrangement, no organizational structure. Ironically, this anarchistic arrangement meant that our teacher made all the decisions in a benevolent but authoritarian manner. We were content with this process. He was our wise, gentle teacher, and we could only be followers. A tolerant teacher as well. Senzaki was not only infinitely patient with us, he welcomed visitors warmly. Even theosophists and spiritualists whose ideas he found ridiculous. I remember one day overhearing his conversation with someone who was holding forth on the occult mysteries of the pyramids. And his part in the discussion was to say respectfully at intervals, "Oh, really? I didn't know that." In meetings, his talks were full of Zen stories. We lived in hopes that we would gradually come to understand them, assured by his words, "Zen is not a puzzle. It cannot be solved by wit. It is spiritual food for those who want to learn what life is and what our mission is." As most of you remember, his last words were taped before he died, some years before he died. And Akin says, "I vividly remember sitting in the funeral parlor and listening to him speak for the last time on tape. Friends and Donald, be satisfied with your own head. Do not put any false heads above your own. Then, minute after minute, watch your steps closely. Always keep your head cool and your feet warm. These are my last words to you." Then he added, "Thank you very much, everybody, for taking such good care of me for so long. Bye-bye." And the tape ended with his little laugh. And then I can quote Yogin Senzaki, "America has had Zen students in the past, has them in the present, and will have many of them in the future. They mingle easily with so-called worldlings. They play with children, respect kings and beggars, and handle gold and silver as pebbles and stones." So I'm going to share a few passages with you from the Shogokan. And the frontispiece that Yogin Senzaki wrote is, "The Buddha body is omnipresent. Each sentient being beholds it. Through aspiration and karma relation, as it dwells eternally on this seat of meditation." This is what you are here doing. Yes? The Buddha body is omnipresent. It's throughout. There is nowhere where it is not manifesting. Each sentient being beholds it. Some sentient beings are very tiny. They are beholding it. Others, maybe like elephants, are beholding it. Through aspiration and karma relation. So we human beings have aspiration to behold him, which brings us to practice this aspiration and our own karmic relation, the causes and effects of our lives. Many, 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 many lives bring us to this. As it dwells internally on this seat of meditation, so you are on the seat of meditation as this Buddha body, no separation whatsoever. Then he goes into a very long but beautiful footnote. So we made a star after meditation, and then the star goes to the footnote. And the big question is, do I read the footnote? Yes, I think so. It's a very trendy title. It is the inherent nature of the Buddha body that it individualizes itself in myriad manifestations in the phenomenal world. It does not stand alone outside particular existences, but abides in them, animates them, and makes them move freely. In this form, it is subjected to certain conditions, such as time, space, and causation. Its essence is infinite, but its manifestations are finite and limited. So here we are, finite, limited manifestations, sitting here, meeting it here. It's my footnote on the footnote. It is for this reason that the Buddha body has to wait until conditions are matured before expressing itself. As Hiroshi always said, the readiness of time. Each one of us will be. Suppose that there is a mirror. The mirror of the Buddha. Anything that comes in front of it is reflected without any premeditation on the part of the mirror. Beautiful or ugly, high or low, rich or poor, good or evil, everything is reflected impartially. In other words, the mirror doesn't say, "Oh, I'd like to do better than you." Impartially, completely, clearly present. Wherever and whenever conditions are correct, all particular things will be reflected in the mirror or mind essence of the Buddha body without hesitation, without reasoning, without demonstration. It is thus that the principle of karma works. Although things are many and subject to constant transformation and regulation by their karma, the Buddha body abides eternally on the seat of Bodhi, our inmost being. The moon is shining serenely in the sky, casting her reflection in countless places, wherever conditions are mature. We see her image on the smallest trace of water or on a vast expanse, which may be polluted or clean, but each reflects the same moon according to its nature. The shadows also are as numerous as the bodies of water, but we cannot say that one shadow is essentially different from the others, nor that the moon left her orbit even for a moment. So, I think because the time is such that we really don't have a chance to go into the Shudoka, what I'll do is I'll tell you about the person who wrote Yoka Daishi. Daishi's great teacher, Yoka Genkaku. Do you know who he went to as a teacher to certify his own enlightenment? Anyone remember from having read Shudoka? It's someone we're all very familiar with, because in Dharma study, that's a good clue, right? So who is it? Eno Wenang, the sixth ancestor. He was an outstanding disciple of Wenang. As a youth, he studied the sutras and shastras, but it was through the reading of Vimalakirti Sutra, which some of you remember reading in Dharma study two decades ago, while we're on the subject of years, right? It was through the reading of the Vimalakirti Sutra that he realized intuitively the mystery of his own mind. As you may recall from a recent Dharma study, there was someone who came to awakening through the Lotus Sutra. And this is true of Akalina, right? Great Kensho, greatest of all, came through reading the Lotus Sutra. Wenang himself came to realization through listening. What did he hear?
It
was the mind that awakened him. We do this almost every Dharma study. The Diamond Sutra, right? Develop mind. This is why we can't remember. Nothing whatsoever. Congratulations. Anyway, so again, Kogli said to someone he met who was a student of the sixth ancestor, Ensaku, said, I have not yet had a teacher to verify and confirm my attainment. And he asked him, can you testify for me? And his friend said, no. But in Soke, the sixth ancestor is to be found. And people come in great numbers to learn from him. So they met. And Genkaku walked around the sixth ancestor three times, then stood still without making any bows. Noting his discourtesy, the ancestor said, a Buddhist monk is the embodiment of 3,000 moral precepts and 80,000 minor disciplinary rules. I wonder where you come from and what makes you so arrogant. Kapu said, since the question of incessant rebirth is a momentous one and death may come at any moment, I have no time to waste on ceremony. and wish you to give me a quick answer to this problem. Oh, innocent. Why do you not realize the principle of birthlessness and thus solve the problem of the transiency of life? To realize the essence of mind is to be free of rebirth and Kapalika. Once this problem is solved, the question of transiency exists no longer. That is so. When this moment, Genkaku made vows, according to the ceremony of departure. You are going away too quickly, are you not? Asked. Wait. How can there be quickness when motion does not exist intrinsically? Genkaku answered. Who knows that motion does not exist? Asked the sixth ancestor. I hope you will not particularize, Genkaku observed. The ancestor then commended him for his thorough grasp of the idea of birthlessness. But Genkaku countered, is there an idea in birthlessness? Without an idea, who can particularize? Asked the ancestor. That which particularizes is not an idea, replied Genkaku. Well said, exclaimed sixth ancestor. Then asked Genkaku to delay his departure and spend the night there. From that time on, Genkaku was known as the enlightened one who had spent a night with the patriarch. And there's another note, just very short. Shodoka is memorized in its entirety by students in China, Korea, and Japan, and they are often inspired during its recitation. So the next time I give a talk here, how about June 20, whatever, my holiday. Yes, I will go into it. And in the meantime, you can get copies for yourself and memorize it. And then we will all be on the same pages. As you can see, I have annotated my copy, maybe a bit. But this one, being a first edition, not a single mark, only poems. Thank you. So because of the time, we have to stop at this point, but at least you have a taste. Let's do that.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.